Hello, welcome everyone to another edition of the Kennedy's Medical Law Matters podcast. I'm Rob Tobin, head of the Medical Law Group here at Kennedy's, where we act on behalf of NHS and public sector organisations and private healthcare providers on all aspects of healthcare and medical law. For those new to this Medical Law Matters podcast, we use this as an opportunity to chat about topical issues in medical law and hope to generate interest and debate amongst listeners. Over previous episodes, which are all available on your usual platforms, Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, we have discussed, amongst other things, best interests, mental capacity, the law around the medical treatment of children, assisted dying, media scrutiny, and there's been a bit of philosophy thrown in. Today, we thought we'd give you a bit of a day in the life of a medical lawyer. So we'll be talking through a court of protection case from start to finish, hopefully sharing some useful and practical tips for clinicians, lawyers, and students. I'm delighted today to be joined by two of my colleagues from the Medical Law Group, Dan Freeman, who's a partner, and Indy Kaur, who is a legal director. Dan, you might remember, joined me on episode 4 when we talked about the assisted dying bill. And this is Indy's debut on the podcast. So welcome, Indy. I'll let you introduce yourselves. So Dan, do you want to go first?
Thanks so much, Rob. As Rob said, and I'm pleased to be back, I'm partner in the healthcare division. I've been a partner at Kennedy's for around 6 years now, but I've been at Kennedy's for 17 years. I can't believe I'm still saying that. And I specialise in claims, inquests, mental health and court protection.
I'm Indy Kaur, and as Rob says, I'm legal director, and I've been at Kennedy's for almost 5 years now in the medical law group team, and I specialise in court protection and inquest work.
Thank you. So welcome both. Let's get right into it. And let me start by introducing the discussion. The court of protection has sometimes been described as the most misunderstood of courts in England and Wales. I think that's changed over the last few years with far more transparency and openness in its approach. But critics are still out there and they will say that there is more to go and more transparency and openness to reach. So today, I suppose, we'll be talking about what it is, what the court of protection is, when you should go there, whether it's adversarial, what happens when you go there, what happens when a family or a patient or someone fundamentally disagrees with the doctors about, say, life-saving treatment, and many other things in between. So to explore this, we'll talk through a case study. So it's one of our cases, or we've changed it to avoid identifying any of the people involved, but it's based on something we've worked on fairly recently. So it concerns a 31-year-old man with cancer who now lacks mental capacity to make treatment decisions, and his mother was strongly opposed to any further chemotherapy. Let's start though with the basics. So Dan, can I ask you the first question? You know, what is the court of protection?
Thanks, Rob. So the court of protection is a court that was established by the Mental Capacity Act 2005. And it's there to make decisions on behalf of people. I'm not going to call them patients because it doesn't always involve patients. It involves people who lack capacity or whether their capacity is queried. Generally, it deals with two areas, so health and welfare and property and affairs. But within that, it does look at other things. So it looks at other elements such as capacity and consent to treatment, powers of attorney, advanced decisions, vulnerable adults, and also decisions over whether a non-capacious patient would like to live, for example, and whether placements are correct for them, or generally whether it's in their best interest to go and live in a particular place, in a particular part of the country, or in a particular placement with particular facilities. It also, and there have been, of course, in papers in recent years, decisions about life-sustaining treatment as well. Of course, they're the most publicised. But ultimately, it's not there to take away decisions for people. It is there really to assess in a holistic approach a person who lacks capacity or query capacity to look in their best interests of what should happen to them, for them. And that's in discussion with all of those around.
Just for listeners, it's there for adults, isn't it?
The court of protection is there for adults. Children are dealt with under different frameworks, but they do look at similar areas, and they'll be dealt with by the family court.
Thank you. And often, as we know, it's basically the same judge with a different hat on. So you might end up going to the High Court on one day for a court of protection hearing involving a 31-year-old, and the next day or even the next afternoon, you might well see the same judge in the same court presiding over a case concerning an 11-year-old. So that's maybe one of the reasons. So there can be some confusions. But let's go into this case study, and Indy, I'll bring you in a sec. So it's 3 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon, and we get an urgent email, and it's marked urgent, and it's from one of our NHS Trust clients. So this one is from an acute trust client, and it says in the email that they have a patient who's a 31-year-old man who has a serious cancer diagnosis, and he has already undergone some chemotherapy for his cancer, and that's been over about a year, and he has developed some psychosis. No one's quite sure the cause of that, if it's linked with any of the treatment he's had or if it's just a coincidence. He can't now understand or weigh treatment decisions. So I think although we don't know this yet, the implication is he could before. So his mother, and it says in this email that his mother believes that the chemotherapy that the oncologists have recommended has caused the psychosis, and she's strongly opposed to further treatment. But doctors say more chemotherapy is needed to save his life. If he doesn't have the chemotherapy, he's going to die quite soon. So I suppose let's ask, what are the legal questions? What's going on in your head if you're reading this email?
So initially, I guess the legal issues to understand is whether or not the individual, the 31-year-old male, whether or not he lacks capacity to decide about the treatment, the chemotherapy that's been offered, and then to go on and then assess whether or not actually the chemotherapy is in his best interest. So those would be the two legal questions that would underpin any conversations that were had with the clinicians.
Do you find that there can sometimes be confusion, particularly amongst some clinicians, where let's say someone who has a mental health diagnosis and there's almost this automatic assumption that they therefore lack capacity to make decisions about, in this case, cancer?
Yeah, I think there is sometimes a misconception that the presence of a mental health disorder or psychosis automatically equates to a lack of capacity. I think the important point to note here, though, is that where we have a mental health disorder, that would be underpinned by a different legal framework under the Mental Health Act 1983. But I think absolutely, I think sometimes a diagnosis of mental health doesn't itself establish incapacity. So capacity is both, as you know, decision-specific and time-specific. And so it must be assessed in accordance with the Mental Capacity Act statutory test.
Thank you. Yeah. And of course, there will be cases, quite a few cases we come across where someone may well be sectioned under the Mental Health Act, but nonetheless, we still need to go to the Court of Protection because the treatment, if we decide that they lack capacity or we have to ask that question, the treatment that we need a judge to make a decision on in terms of best interest isn't something that can be provided without consent under the Mental Health Act. So that can be a whole nother topic of a podcast, I think. Now, we have a podcast on mental capacity, but for the purposes of today, Dan, do you want to sort of step in and just give a brief overview of what that capacity test is?
Yeah, of course. And I think it always needs to be remembered, though, that the basic starting point is that capacity is presumed unless proven otherwise. So what has to happen to even get through the door, as it were, of the court of protection is to look at whether someone lacks capacity. So effectively, that presumption has to be set aside or dislodged, if I can put it that way. And the way that is set out in the Mental Capacity Act is we have to look at whether there's an impairment of the functioning of the mind or brain. And because of that impairment, is the person unable to understand information relevant to a decision, retain any information in regard to that decision, use or weigh up that information as part of the process of decision making, and communicate that decision. So I think we always need to remember that it is very decision specific. And as you and Indy have said, it has to be in regard to that specific decision. So just because somebody lacks the capacity to decide where to live doesn't necessarily mean that they lack the capacity about their own healthcare.
Absolutely. Thank you. So that's the, and I suppose it ought to be said that here, the psychosis may mean he can't weigh the risks and benefits of the chemotherapy. It may not. And that's something we need to get the clinicians to really delve into. And if he can't use or weigh that information because of delusional thinking, then he may well lack capacity. But there are times when the answer to the question, does he have capacity to make this particular decision, is I don't know. And in those cases, we can go to the Court of Protection to ask that question first. And if the answer is they lack capacity, then we can go on to the next point, which is best interests. So I think, as Indy said at the beginning, if someone lacks capacity to make a particular decision, then we can ask the Court of Protection what treatment, or sometimes what non-treatment, is in their best interests. Okay, let's move on, if we could, to, you know, go back to the practicalities. So when do you need to go to court? So presumably, Dan, there are times when you can, you know, you can advise a doctor that person lacks capacity and it's quite clear what's in their best interests and you don't need to go to court. Is that right?
So there are times when you don't have to go to court. So if everybody is in agreement about a particular way of treating somebody, so whether that is, so that would include the clinicians, the next of kin, or if the nearest relative or family members, if everyone's in agreement, then the guidance says that we don't need to go to court protection. The guidance that I've just said is the guidance of Mr. Justice Hayden. And if you have a quick Google after this, or if you want to get in contact with Rob or I, and Indy, we can direct you to where that guidance is. But in that guidance, Mr. Justice Hayden sets out when you must go to court protection, when you should consider going to court protection, when you don't need to go to court protection. So we've covered off and you don't need to go to court protection. But when you must and when you must consider going to court protection, it's generally broken down into if a decision is life-sustaining, if there's a genuine dispute between those involved in the care of, I'm just going to use the letter P, because that is what's used in the court protection. So I think P is short for patient. Whether the case is finally balanced and the consequences are grave. And lots of the time, we find anyway, that actually the main reason, well, I certainly have applications that go to court protection, is when there is a dispute about that care and what should happen. So for example, in this example, you've already mentioned that a query is a dispute between the clinicians and a family member about what type of care. And that will always be a discussion between clinicians and the family. So there's always going to be a dispute in that regard.
I just want to clear up a misconception that sometimes arises in the context of hospitals generally. And that's, you know, you mentioned next of kin just before, Dan. You're absolutely right that next of kin, family members, they are crucial. And the Mental Capacity Act sets out that they should be consulted when making decisions about a person's best interests. But one thing that's really, I want to drive home, is that the next of kin can't make decisions on behalf of a patient. What they can do is discuss and consult with the clinicians and other people involved in their care in order to, I suppose, educate around what might be in the person's best interests. So they can give you an insight into that person's wishes, values, feelings, and beliefs when at a time that they had capacity, if they did have capacity in the past, and in terms of what, you know, they may have said things in the past that you, the clinician, may not know because you've only met this person today for the first time ever. So in our scenario, we do have a mother involved, but it's a mother of a 31-year-old adult. So unlike in children cases where a mother could or would have parental responsibility and is the decision maker, or at least one of them. With adults, they're not decision makers per se. Bit of a caveat though, of course, there are LPAs, and that's a lasting power of attorney, which is another podcast we can talk about later on. Okay, let's go back to this scenario then. So Indy, if I can bring you in, you've got your email. And the next step, presumably, is to call the client and arrange a meeting.
Yes, absolutely. So we've had the instructions and we then arrange to meet with the clinicians or certainly staff that are heavily involved with the individual, just to give us an update and status as to what is happening on the ground and also to inform us of conversations that have been had with family. So in this particular scenario, the mother of P, but also any conversations that I've had and discussions with P himself, and for them to tell us about those conversations, but also to inform us about why they think the chemotherapy is in the best interests of P and the risks and the benefits of that treatment. So that's really, really important. And really, you would want to sort of understand the capacity element of it, most importantly, because, of course, as we've already said, assessing whether or not somebody has capacity, if P lacks capacity, that is the only way that the court of protection can seize jurisdiction in the matter. So it's absolutely essential that we are clear that P lacks capacity to make the decision that we are looking at. Once it is established that P lacks capacity, then we can go on to advise, and we would typically request medical records, any other evidence in terms of the diagnosis and prognosis, any psychiatric evidence, which if it's an acute hospital, we may need to obtain information from the mental health trust if one is involved. And as I've said, really trying to understand the risks and the benefits of the treatment proposed. But also, as you say, Rob, the evidence of past wishes is very, very important. And that's something that family can usually offer an insight to.
Thank you. And that's a lot of evidence to gather. So just to break it down, you've got the medical evidence. So that's from presumably an oncologist in this case to set out why it is that they're recommending the chemotherapy. You've presumably then also got a psychiatrist to talk about the patient's, well, the mental capacity, but also the psychosis. You mentioned the medical records, which have to be scrutinized. Presumably we might need to speak to a nurse to get something from them to set out what, you know, on a day-to-day basis, what the patient is like. How do you go about getting all that evidence quickly? I mean, first of all, presumably you need to ask how urgent this is.
Absolutely. And you know, often these cases are very urgent, which gives you a very short time frame to scrutinize absolutely everything that I've highlighted in my response earlier. I think the key issues is obviously if you are looking to go to court sort of within 24 hours, which does happen, then you would ideally be trying to gather the evidence in the first instance as much as you can glean from the conversations that you've had with the clinicians and certainly the treatment plan. Often courts, what they would want to see in such a short time frame is a witness statement, if you can get that together with the clinicians, just highlighting again the risks and benefits of why this treatment is proposed, but also a treatment plan setting out exactly what that treatment would be. And you would do that really via conversations, I would say, in the first instance. Medical records are important and it is important to scrutinize them as much as you can. But sometimes these can be quite lengthy and quite detailed, and it's quite difficult to go through absolutely everything with a fine-tooth comb in the short time that you have. So you would literally have to assess which parts of the information that you are gathering are going to be presented to court in the time frame that you have.
Thank you. And presumably the clinicians will need a lot of support, particularly if they've never done anything like this before.
Absolutely. It's often, you know, clinicians will call up, and I think sometimes that there's this idea that, you know, we've told the lawyers to make an application to the Court of Protection and that is it. But unfortunately, a lot of the information that we have to gather is from the clinicians, because of course they are the ones that can tell us what the treatment plan would be and what the risks and benefits of that would be as well, and including any conversations, as I said, that they've had, so that we can put it all into witness statements and present it.
Thank you. And so just to summarise the evidence, the paper evidence, if you like. So you've had your email and then you've had your first meeting with the treating clinicians, the team. And ideally, I think what we're saying is we'd want a witness statement from the oncologist setting out what treatment they're recommending and why, and also the consequences of not receiving that treatment and timescales around that. A statement also from probably a nurse to set out a bit more about the patient's capacity and understanding, perhaps some past wishes and feelings if the nurse has been treating patient for a while, but also that nurse might be able to assist with the practicalities of how can this chemotherapy be given, particularly if it's having to be given without a person's consent. Dan, what about, I mean, we talked about the clinicians. How do we involve the, and how important is it to involve the family?
It's hugely important because often in these situations, of course you are, and as you should be, putting P at the center of it. So it should all be about the best interests of the patient or the person. But really, sometimes, of course, if a patient has been in a hospital for a while, or if there's been a different sort of opinion, sometimes those opinions can become entrenched with each other. And whilst we're all supposed to be looking at P, sometimes those emotions and views can get stuck. So we would always try different ways to try and talk to the family. So whether that be trying to get a second opinion involved to see if someone objective can come in. If that is not beneficial, perhaps if we have time, that is, see if we can get a mediator to come in, an independent person to talk between the parties to see if they can, you know, cut through the grey area between it. But sometimes, just unfortunately, because people, this is in a very emotive time for people, looking at people's care and treatment. And sometimes emotions can boil over. And of course, then when you start involving court proceedings as well, again, people may retreat to their corners. But it is always important to try and engage with the family, whether that be by a nurse that they like, whether it be with the legal team, whether it be with a clinician that they get on with. Of course, again, because sometimes patients have been involved for a long time, then again, people's views of each other may boil over. So we should always try and talk to the family. That I think that's just the upshot, and try and get them to engage and see if there's a way around the problem, if there's a specific sticking point.
Let's talk about timescales, because I said at the beginning that the email came, I think I said 3 o'clock. And at the first meeting, as Indy says, one of the main questions, the early questions to be asked will be, how urgent is this? And that will be a clinical question. And one of the tests is, you know, if someone had capacity, if you were treating someone with mental capacity, what would you be recommending to them and why and how quickly? And in this particular case, I remember it was pretty urgent. There'd already been a delay in starting or restarting this chemotherapy, and the doctors were recommending that it was restarted by the next Monday. So we're on Thursday now, and it was the next Monday. So that really sped things up, and it meant that all of the evidence that Indy described, or those witness statements and the treatment plan, needed to be gathered very quickly. And so 3 o'clock, the email comes in. Let's say 3:10, we have the initial phone call with the legal services lead at the trust. And it's often, if we can, if the trust can, and we rely heavily on our colleagues at the trust, we would want that first meeting with the treating clinicians to be within the hour. So let's say by about 4:30 PM. And then we would be asking the clinicians to produce those witness statements again really quickly, within a few hours, or possibly by the next morning. And the other evidence that we'd need, as Indy, you know, we're talking about the capacity, is this thing called a COP3. So that COP stands for Court of Protection, and it's the COP3 is the number 3 form, which a clinician is asked to fill out to set out why they believe the person lacks the mental capacity to make that particular decision. So all of those things are going on in the background. The other thing, or the other important aspect that we need to think about, is how is P going to be represented? Who's going to speak for P? And, you know, in this case, we have his mother who is certainly very heavily involved and has a very strong opinion. But what we don't know, and this is the point of going to the Court of Protection, what we don't know is whether his mum is actually acting in his best interests. You know, is she thinking in the same way that he would think if he had capacity? So, Indy, who would we involve to speak on behalf of P?
So we have what's called the official solicitor, who is frequently appointed where there's no suitable family member or friend or willing to act on behalf of P. So the official solicitor would be instructed sort of at the start of proceedings and usually invited by the court. So there is a direction in an order actually inviting the official solicitor to act, you know, on P's behalf. So the role of this official solicitor is to step into the shoes of P and will also assess all the evidence that is going to be put before the court and will usually have quite a lot of questions that will not challenge the evidence that is put there, but certainly to scrutinise everything and ensure that we are still all working towards P's best interests.
Presumably a bit like P would. So if he had capacity, what questions would he be asking? Why would he be asking them? Now, would he be demanding a second opinion? That sort of thing. Is that what you mean?
Absolutely. The system is designed really to ensure that P's position is independently and properly advanced before the court.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so Dan, I described that timescale, the urgent nature of it, the fact that we're on a Thursday, and realistically, if treatment needs to start on the Monday, we need to be in court tomorrow, Friday. What needs to be done from a practical perspective to get to that court hearing?
So from a practical perspective, I think you and India talked about what evidence is going to be needed. So, and this perhaps sounds like the rather administrative side, but we as lawyers have to fill out various forms. And you mentioned one, which is COP3, so the capacity one. Then we have COP1, 1B, which is the application, what type of order we're looking for. And that all involves rather mundane elements such as names, addresses, telephone numbers. So we're going to need all of that to be pulled together. We also need, when we have those statements, we also need to fill out the witness statement forms so that we can pull all that together as a bundle. We then also need to pull together the relevant medical records, get that all together. And if we can, and if we've got time, flag to the official solicitor in advance that we're going to be making this application, so they can also be ready and raring to go. I would also, again, it comes down to communication, but speak to the mother and say, this is what we're going to do. These are the draft papers that we're looking for. And the key bit as well, I think Indy said, is about a care plan. What I think we'd be asking, and this is what the court needs to approve, is the care plan. What is it that the trust or the local authority want to specifically do that the court needs to authorise? Whether that be about surgery, whether it be about treatment that is being discussed or disputed. And then we need to pull all of that together and get that over to the court. And this is where we would instruct counsel. The official solicitor would instruct counsel. We would encourage mum to see if there is anyone that could assist her. Of course, we would always try and assist where we can within the bounds of what we can do, because we can't, if we're not acting for her, we can't advise her what to do. And then we would seek an urgent listing. If it is that day, and if it's a weekday, we'd run off to the High Court and we'd all go in front of the High Court judge. If it's the next day, exactly the same. But if it's out of hours, there are out of hours judges that we can sadly wake up or pull out of a dinner or something like that, who would then hear any hearings by Teams or by whatever remote means possible. There we'd have everyone on the call and we'd run through it as if we're in person. With everything, though, because it is still a court process, if it is remote, I would fully expect everyone to still be ties, blazers, the works, if the videos are on, and we'd run it from there. So those are the practicalities, and there are ways and means of working with it. It's just on a weekend, it might take a little bit more time to get people at their desks, whereas on a weekday, everyone is generally at their desks and available.
Thank you. And so the High Court, that's in London in the Strand, but it may well be that your very busy oncologist, nurse, psychiatrist has a full clinic the next day or is on the ward the next day. Indy, you're having your meeting with the with those clinicians, and they're possibly a bit petrified, anxious, to say the least. They're going to have to give evidence before a high court judge the next day. First of all, do they have to turn up in person? Secondly, what would you be saying to them? How would you be guiding them around what to expect?
So obviously, for the clinicians, I mean, given that there's such a short time frame, it's quite a rapid evidence gathering exercise. And as I say, that the clinicians are really at the fore of obtaining all of that information. So as well as their own clinical commitments and patient care that they are having to deliver, they are taking the time out to also assist with this court application. So that in itself is quite intense because they're having to manage both expectations. In terms of giving evidence, often we can ask the court, and we do often ask the court for the hearing to be remote to assist the clinicians so that they don't have to travel in between their patient care duties. And so that is often something that the court would be willing to authorise. And so a lot of the hearings are remote for that purpose.
Or hybrid,
yes,
presumably.
Yes, or hybrid. So if someone does want to appear in person, sometimes it's a case that lawyers are required to attend in person, but the clinicians can give evidence remotely.
Mm-hmm. And does the judge ever have an opportunity to see and or speak to the patient?
Yes. I've had many cases where the patient themselves have requested to speak to the judge, and that can be done during the hearing itself with everyone present, or it can be done in private. Often I found it has been in private, but judges generally they feel there's a huge benefit in speaking to PEE themselves about their treatment or whatever the issue may be before the court.
Yeah. And where it is in private, I know the official solicitor is usually, well, nearly always present, because they need to produce a note so that the other parties can see that note, just to check that.
I was going to say that in the case that I've dealt with, Patricia, as it's called, the judge heard from Patricia herself and found it hugely beneficial to be able to understand exactly what her wishes and feelings are in respect of the case. That was an eating disorder case, so hugely complex and difficult. Patricia was said to lack capacity in relation to the treatment decisions. The court found real value in hearing from her directly, and that her evidence assisted the judge in understanding her wishes and feelings and lived experience of her illness.
Yeah, and that was a very interesting case, because I think I'm right. In that case, certainly in the first hearings, was deemed to have capacity to litigate the case, but not to have capacity to make decisions about her eating disorder. That's right, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, so we've explained to the clinicians what's involved with giving evidence. We have got our witness statements, we've got our hugely important care treatment plan, we've submitted the forms to the court, we've instructed counsel, we've notified the official solicitor, we have kept mother informed, we've also, presumably through the clinicians, told P what's going on, and that's absolutely crucial so that he has an opportunity to give evidence, to speak to the judge. These are obviously in the cases where P is communicative. There will be cases where the patient is, say, in a coma or something, but certainly in a case like this, P should have a literal and a metaphorical voice. We move on to the next day, and let's say that the court is able to find a slot for a hearing. So we go to court. What happens? Dan, do you want to just paint a picture? You can describe the High Court as you walk in. What's going on, and what do we do at that court hearing?
Oh, so what will happen is that if there are clinicians listening to us, what we will do is we'll probably meet up. If you are coming in person, we'll probably meet up beforehand at counsel's chambers, and we'll tell you where to meet, just so that we know that you are calm, collected, and that you are where you are, and you are going to arrive on time. And then we'll walk up together. Unfortunately, you have to go through airport style security to go through. And then in the High Court, we'll walk through this rather magnificent building, and then we'll find our way to the Court of Protection and the and the court that would have been allocated to the day or listed in. There we'll see the representatives of the official solicitor. We'll probably see mum as well. And we'll all be outside, and there'll probably be some last minute discussions about whether there is any other way around this, or whether this is the only particular treatment that can be provided. And Rob, also, I'm taking this to be arguably a final hearing rather than other directions hearing.
Yeah.
Purely because directions hearing, for our listeners as well, is, again, it's relatively administrative for purposes of gathering evidence.
Sorry, and yeah, so, you're absolutely right, Dana. And a directions hearing would be for a more standard court of protection case where you haven't got to make a decision, or a treatment doesn't have to start in 3 days' time.
That's right. So once there have been various discussions outside, we'll be called in. And then what will happen is that there'll be a knock at the door, judge will walk in, and we'll all stand up. And then what will happen is that the case will be introduced, and then the judge will have more of a general conversation with the advocates on the front bench. So what will happen is that the judge will hopefully say they've read the papers, or at least have a grasp of the papers in general. And then we'll ask the applicant's barrister, so probably our barrister, you know, effectively, what is it I'm being asked to do? What's the background? What is it I'm being asked to approve? Are there any issues? What are the issues I need to consider? Then the judge will go down the bench to the official solicitor who's representing P and say, have you met them? You know, what is their view? Is there any view? What are their wishes and feelings? Have you been able to discuss that? And then after that, they'll go to mum, who'll be able to have a conversation with the judge. And I find that the judges are incredibly affable to family members. They're incredibly friendly. So I wouldn't, you know, consider it to be adversarial, like we've said before as well. If the judge needs to see or hear any evidence, if our clinicians are remote, they'll be on Teams, and then what will happen is they'll be sworn in. And if they are religious, they will swear on the holy book that they promise by Almighty X, Y, and Z that they would tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. Or if they're not particularly religious, they'll affirm that they promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And then what will happen is they'll give their evidence. Again, in the same vein with mum, the judge will be incredibly friendly, because it's not trying to find liability. It is trying to find out what is it actually is in the best interest of this person. And they'll say, you know, what are the risks and benefits of this? Could a lower dose be given? Should a higher dose be given? Well, actually, is there a final outcome that we can reach today? Do we need some more expert evidence? And then after that, you'll give your evidence. And then the official solicitor will get to ask some questions, and then mum. And then after that, they'll be stood down. And then effectively, the judge goes away, perhaps for an hour or so, or if it's more complex, overnight, and will make their order. It can be quite quick, but the judge may just give a quick decision there and then. And then we can find out straight away, and then we can ring the trust and say, right, okay, you can get on with X, Y, and Z care plan. It's been approved. And then we'll get the final order over to you as and when it's produced by the court.
Thank you. And I suppose, Indy, this, you know, we're talking very practically here and almost matter-of-factly. But of course, these cases are the most profoundly emotional, delicate, sensitive matters concerning life and death. Just looking at that human tension potentially, how difficult is it for you as a lawyer, but also for the clinicians and everyone involved in that process to walk that tightrope to ensure that the legal process and the practicalities are followed, but also that the human element isn't lost?
So I think they're hugely difficult, actually. I mean, sometimes these types of cases, situations that can be so emotionally charged, because families often equate continued treatment with love and loyalty, whereas perhaps clinicians may view further intention as prolonging suffering. So there's all sorts of issues at hand that need to be balanced and weighed up. And I think really in those situations, lawyers and the court is then really required to stand back from both positions and apply an objective test. Again, going back to the best interest test for P.
Have you ever been, I suppose a question for both of you, but Indy, you first, have you ever been involved in a case where the emotions have got too much and actually it has become quite adversarial?
Yes, I have. A number of cases, actually. And it is difficult because you can see the perspective of all the parties involved. And as I say, it's a difficult decision. I mean, it's usually why we have ended up at the Court of Protection in the first place, because it's such a difficult decision to make. It's just, again, the court is there really to look at it objectively and to hear all opinions and then make that best interest decision for P. But yes, it has been, I've been involved in a number of cases where there's also been damage to therapeutic relations between families and clinicians, but also families with the lawyers of various organisations and parties as well. And whilst the Court of Protection isn't there to apportion blame, it can sometimes seem quite adversarial.
Mm. Dan?
Yes, I've been in various cases where emotions have bubbled over. It's perhaps just the easiest way to describe it, because we are talking about the care particularly and the most intimate details of people's lives as well. And people do get hugely emotionally invested, especially if a patient has been in hospital for quite some time. You know, those family members are taking time off work, they're stressed, they're tired already. And to throw some lawyers into the mix, you can see that bubbling over. But what you, from a lawyer perspective and from a clinical perspective, and I know this is me speaking from my ivory tower, but you almost need to try and compartmentalize it and just try not to make it any worse of a difficult situation than it already is. So just because it's court proceedings doesn't mean you can't go over and say hello or good morning to somebody.
Mm.
And sometimes just that little bit of humanity will make it a lot easier for everybody. Of course, people are also, I think, worried from a clinical perspective about, because it's effectively a public court, any names being out in the public domain. And another element that we can discuss as well, and because P will be anonymized, we'll always apply for what's called a transparency order, where we will try and, of course, keep P's name not public, because it's not in the public interest for people to know the most intimate details of somebody's life who didn't ask to be there. But also we'll be asking for clinicians to have their names to be anonymized for some time, because of course those clinicians didn't go to work that day for that to happen. But and if that can give some form of comfort about providing opinions in that court, then I hope that does.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you both. And I suppose in a case such as this, what we're talking about is, first of all, a mother who's trying to protect her son. The clinicians will see it as, or see her decision or her views as contrary to saving her son's life, but she won't see it that way. And it's important not to forget that she is only there to protect her son in her eyes. Doctors trying to save his life and trying to advocate for what they perceive to be the best interests, the most appropriate treatment, the only treatment that can save his life. And importantly, in a case like this, to save a life that can go on to be fulfilling. You know, there are some cases we deal with where the decision is a lot more nuanced, because there may be some pretty awful treatment that's being recommended, but the person has very poor prognosis anyway. And then there are other questions about futility and whether or not treatment is in their best interests. But of course, and the other aspect is that, you know, there's a young man whose illness has taken away his voice. The illness here being the psychosis and his inability to make decisions for himself. So we're all there to step in to try to facilitate a judge in this case to make decisions in his best interests as best they can. So in this particular case, I know that the judge made the decision that it was lawful and in P's best interests to have the chemotherapy. And so the judge made a declaration effectively based on that care treatment plan that we had submitted the day before. And the declaration said that it's lawful to, and in the patient's best interests, to give the chemotherapy and to do so with restraint and sedation as required, using the least restrictive means possible and using all reasonable and proportional means to do so. On a practical basis, what happens is you get the order that the judge has made. They do hand down a judgment to setting out their reasons, but it's the order that's the really important document that we ask the clinicians to put on the patient's medical records, and it gets shown to the patient and it gets shared with the mum. And so the clinicians can then go away and start, and they did start the chemotherapy treatment for the patient the next week. And there are times when, particularly for these really emergency, urgent cases, a judge will want parties to come back, say a week later when the dust has settled, to get an update and to double check that everything is in place and there are no further orders or declarations that need to be made. But each case is different. But it was, I think, quite a succinct microcosm of the day in the life of one of these cases. And if there's one thing to think about, to take away from this podcast, I think remember that the court of protection is not there to remove someone's autonomy. It's not there to force something on someone. It's about safeguarding the patient, particularly when they've lost capacity. And it's working out as best any of us can what the patient would want, what they would decide if they had capacity. It's not to ask, what do I think is right for the patient? It's not to ask the mum, what does she think is right for the patient? It's to ask the mum, the clinician, the judge, what is right for the patient and what would the patient decide if they had the mental capacity to make that decision for themselves. So thank you, Dan. Thank you, Indy, for such a fascinating discussion. I hope listeners found it useful to get an insight into the sometimes fairly fraught world of being a medical lawyer. Please do subscribe to this podcast on the usual platforms, Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, and on our website. Please do let us know if there's any suggested topics you'd find interesting. And do come back to us with any questions about this topic. And please join us next time. I'm going to be speaking with the fantastic Professor Hugh Montgomery, who is an intensive care consultant, and we'll be talking about the futility of treatment and the difficult decisions intensive care doctors have to make alongside their patients and relatives in these most trying of circumstances. Thank you.